we've got to the start of Avalokiteshvara's reply to Shariputra, and the brief answer at the beginning of practice is to correctly and repeatedly behold those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. So of course we need to really understand what do we mean by this empty of inherent nature and how do we come about to realize that. And to help us in that, what we're going through at the moment is having a look at the idea of emptiness and selflessness within the four philosophical schools, because the earlier philosophical schools can provide a good basis and stepping stone to the view that we're about to investigate. And so if we can really start to appreciate these views from the earlier schools, then that sets us up in a good way to try to understand what means by empty of inherent nature. So that's what we're sort of trying to do at the moment. In the last session, we looked at the first two schools, the Vaibhashika Satrantika, who really, these two schools are coming from the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Four Noble Truths teachings. And in these teachings, the problem, the reason we're stuck in samsara is because we grasp onto a self of person. We overinflate the sense of me, and that the world as it appears to us is not a problem. So we don't need to worry about that. We're just focusing on me, the person, and our grasping onto this in a false way. And so what we saw was that we can talk about this coarse and subtle selflessness of person. The coarse idea was this unitary, unchanging, independent self that was asserted by some traditions at the time of the Buddha. But the one that we really need to pay attention to is the second one, this idea of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. This idea of master controller, that there seems to be this me here somewhere that is trying to run the show. And this me that seems to be here somewhere seems to be more than just the body and the mind. There seems to be something a little bit in addition that stands apart a bit, that is really self-sufficient. And experientially, it doesn't seem like it depends on anything else to exist. So this is this idea of self, the master controller, that we need to get rid of, this grasping onto that. Now we're going to look at the second two schools, Chittamatra and Majjhimika. Now both of those schools, of course, say that grasping onto this self-sufficient, substantial me will cause problems. But both schools say there's also a deeper level of ignorance operating. So let's have a look at those two schools now. Firstly, the Chittamatra school, which comes out of the third turning of the wheel of Dharma. And to introduce this Chittamatra view, I want to read again from His Holiness's book on page 101 at the bottom. And he says, "In the mind-only view, what is seen as objectively real and existing out there, the object, is nothing more than a projection of our mind, the subject. Thus, subject and object are seen as ultimately non-dual." So, in this Chittamatra system, when we talk about emptiness, we're talking about this world being empty of being external. And often they use this word non-duality. "From a practical perspective, this view is very useful. It is not hard to see how recognizing that the qualities we perceive in objects are merely aspects of our own mind could have a dramatic impact on reducing our attachment to those external objects." So this is one of the practical benefits of this Chittamatra view. If we really understand that this world is not external, it's really a product of the mind, then it becomes difficult to develop attachment to any of these objects that are out there, because we'll know there's nothing out there to grasp, that it's really internal to the mind. A little bit like if we become lucid in a dream. So although the mind-only school rejects the reality of a self and rejects the reality of an external, objective, material reality, it nonetheless maintains that subjective experience, that is to say, the mind, does have substantial reality. Followers of the mind-only school assert that if the mind did not possess an intrinsic substantial reality, there would be no basis upon which to make meaningful distinctions between good and evil, between what is harmful and what is beneficial. They assume that for a phenomena to exist, it has to have an objective substantial basis upon which to posit its various functions. And so we see that if we go back to that four Buddhist tenet systems and we look at Cittamatra, it says a proponent is a person propounding Mahayana tenets, which means the idea of enlightenment, who does not assert external objects but does accept truly existent self-cognition. So again, the mind is something really truly existent and substantial because everything's coming from the mind. So this is the Cittamatra view. So going on a little bit more, it says, and yet in the mind-only view, all things and events are not purely mental constructs. If that were the case, white could become black and black could become white merely by our thinking them so. Since this is not the case, one must therefore accept this view, goes on to assert, that the inner subjective experience, the world of consciousness, also has substantial reality. Consequently, for the mind-only school, the explanations of emptiness found in the Perfectional Wisdom Sutras cannot be taken at face value. They argue that if we were to take statements like there is no form, no feeling, no discriminations, literally, this would constitute falling into the mistaken extreme of nihilism, which contradicts the law of cause and effect. The mind-only understanding of the Buddha's teachings on emptiness in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras is primarily based on a particular set of assertions in the Sutra Unraveling the Thought of the Buddha, which is one of the teachings of the third wheel, which says, in which a theory called the Three Natures is presented in great detail. According to this assertion, all things and events possess three principal natures. Dependent nature, that is, the interplay of various specific causes and conditions, is said to be the basis of a phenomena's existence. Upon the basis of this dependent nature, we project an independent reality onto the phenomena. This imputed nature is what appears to us as real. Finally, the ultimate nature of the phenomena is the negation of this imputation, namely the phenomena's emptiness. So let's have a look at that. So the first nature was here, the dependent nature, which is the fact that everything is produced through causes and conditions. And on that dependent nature of things, we project, we impute that this object is existing external to us. So this is what here is talked about, the imputed nature. Is that we impute or project onto these things the fact that they exist external to us. But upon investigation...
Would it be possible to replace the word nature here with the word phenomena?
No, because these are three things that apply to every phenomenon. Every phenomena has these three natures. So this cup has a dependent nature, meaning it's producing causes and conditions.
Right.
Then, on the basis of that cup, we impute or label, we say, ah, that's an external cup. That's existing external to me. So
it's the three natures of
every phenomena.
Right.
Yes.
Have you got a characteristic?
Characteristic, nature, if you want. I mean, generally they talk about the three natures, so probably better to stick with that because you'll find natures, three natures is the, whatever, most translators use that terminology. Then, of course, here it says that the ultimate nature of that object is that that imputed nature does not exist within the object itself. There is no external cup. So that is its ultimate nature, that this imputed nature is false. So this is emptiness. That emptiness in the Chittamatra system is that things are empty of being external to the mind. And that, if you look in the objects of abandonment chart, in the cognitive obscurations column, you see that the ignorance, this imputed nature, is the conception apprehending form and the valid cognition apprehending that form to be different substances. What that means, of course, is to grasp on to the fact that there is the different substances means that the observer, the mind, and the object are different substances. The mind is mental and that's physical. That's what it means. So effectively what that means is that we are grasping on to the fact that these things that we observe are external to the mind. So that is the false imputed nature. That's what we're doing. We're imputing or labeling that this cup is existing external to the mind. So the ultimate nature or emptiness is to realize that this cup is not external to the mind. Subject-object non-duality. So this is emptiness within the Chittamatra system.
So the three natures are from the Chittamatra.
Yeah. Yeah, the three natures come within the Chittamatra system. They were, they come as part of the Chittamatra system to understand what do we mean by the fact that these appearances are deceiving us and what emptiness means.
So the phenomena also include other person.
Yeah. So again, the same thing, is that like in a dream, you know, people appear to be external to us, but they're a product of the mind. But what this view does not mean is solipsism, which means I'm the only thing that exists in the universe and everyone else is a figment of my imagination. That's not the implication of this view. How this view is working is that, and it's a little bit like the dream analogy, that in our dream, in any moment of experience, there are two things arising in our dream. There's the dream me, and then the world that I'm observing. So those are simultaneous in every moment of our dream. And so they say that that is what's happening here in the waking world, is that in every moment what is arising in experience is the me and the world, like the dream. And so what they're saying is that because we all have similar imprints in our mind, what is arising, our worlds that are arising are so much overlapping that we can communicate with each other. And actually, we can sort of understand this a little bit because, you know, if we're all looking at this cup, I mean, really, we all have slightly different experiences of the cup, but similar enough so that we can communicate. Particularly, I am having quite a different experience to the cup because most of you can't see the handle, which I can see. So, certainly from that perspective, but we can communicate. So that's how Chittamatra say is that we, even though this reality is internal to the mind, where our realities are overlapping so much that we can communicate.
Just a clarification, the non-duality, as per Chitra Mantra, would be very clear only if we see both the selflessness of person and phenomena together.
Right, so what we see here, if we look at the objects of abandonment chart, see, Chittamatra, if we look at afflictive obscurations, we see it's the same, conception of self-sufficient, substantial person. Which means, according to Chittamatra, if we realize selfness as a person, we can become aha, nirvana, we can achieve liberation. If we want to go on to enlightenment, we need to realize this non-duality. That's what's called the cognitive obscuration. So that's the next step we need to do to achieve enlightenment, to realize there is no external world out there. This is the Chittamatra assertion.
Yeah, what I meant to say was that merely realizing the emptiness of phenomenon on a standalone basis will not remove non-duality. For non-duality, one has to see both the selflessness and the emptiness of phenomenon together.
So, see, again, we have to be careful with the word non-duality. What that means in Chittamatra and Majjhimika is not the same. In Chittamatra, non-duality simply means that the world that we experience is not external to the mind. So that's non-duality. But because it's coming from the mind is something very solid and substantial and real. Yeah, because it's the basis from which everything appears. It must be solid. Otherwise, how could all this stuff appear? I mean, all this stuff that appears is like an illusion. But it's coming from something that's real. The mind.
So the projector is real.
Yeah, the projector is real for Chittamatra. And so non-duality just means the projection is not something other than the projector. But the projector is real. Whereas non-duality in the Majjhimika is saying both the subject and object, both of them have no substantial reality. So there's a difference. But we haven't got to that yet.
So why would you stand in the course that you should talk about the emptiness? It's like that it's what comes before you tap in. Like, before you give the name.
Labeling them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
So that's kind of like what they're talking about, the emptiness.
Here, what they're saying is, this imputed nature,
yeah.
You actually, if we go in more detail, there are two types. I can't remember what they were called. False, true, false. Maybe I'm making this up, but true and false, or real and unreal. I can't remember what the terms they used. But what these mean is that on the basis of the dependent nature, these causes and conditions here,
yeah.
We impute. And what is true, or what is, whatever the word they use here, is that it's this cup, it's a cup. That's okay, no problem. But also, we impute that is external to me. That's the false imputation. We impute that this cup is external to my mind. That's the problem. So this is okay, that this is a cup, but what's not okay is that this cup is existing external to the mind. That's emptiness, is to realize that this is not accurate. That there is no external cup. Is that the question?
I mean, because I said what it is. I mean, we're talking about like that, you can, if someone would come from a tribe who didn't never seen something like that, then it would not be a cup for him.
No, but he would still label it as some sort of object.
Something. Yeah,
but
that makes it what it is, right?
Yeah, but that's okay. I mean, that's the conventional world. I mean, we have to do that to make sense of things. So there's no problem. What the Chittamatra is saying is the problem is that in addition to that, we also label or impute that this object is external to our mind. There's an external cup. That's the problem.
When you say external, I'm sorry, could you please say it a bit more? When you say
we'll use the example, the dream.
Yeah.
We're dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
In the dream, there appears to be a dream world there. Okay, in the dream. That dream world appears to be a physical world made up of atoms and solid material, doesn't it? In the dream.
In the dream. Yeah.
In the dream. And that's what we believe. So we're, in the dream, we're imputing this. We're imputing that this dream world is out there external to us. But if we become lucid in the dream, we'll realize even though this appears to exist independent, external to us, it doesn't. Because we know, because we're lucid, that this world is a product of our mind. So that's emptiness. So being lucid in the dream, for the Chittamatrans, is the realization of emptiness, like, well, an analogy for it. In the waking world, we'll come to realize that this waking world is also not as it appears, that it's also a product of the mind, and that is emptiness. So they use the lucid dream analogy to show these two things. But doesn't, if you have like a lot of, if you have a nightmare,
yeah.
Doesn't that actually have a physical negative impact on your body?
Yes.
Directly? But it still has an impact. So isn't it somehow part of your reality?
Yeah.
Okay, the rules in a dream and the waking world are different, but you know what I mean, no?
So there's mental substance in this school.
Yeah.
How many minds are there? Lots or just one?
Lots.
Yeah.
Lots. Yeah.
Some sort of
not one. No. There's no collective consciousness. In fact, no Buddhist school would talk about collective consciousness.
So it's some sort of mental space which we inhabit.
Yeah, and the fact that we have similar imprints in our mind, we are. Our realities are so much overlapping, that's why we can communicate with each other. That's the Chittamatra assertion.
Could you call this out idealism?
I think there are different versions of idealism. Maybe some of them, yes, maybe some, no. Again, I haven't studied so much, but I think even within idealism there are different versions. So maybe that would fit one of them, but maybe not the others. Yeah.
So, mind in Buddhism? Yet there are individual minds? Or?
Yes, individual minds. I mean, in all Buddhist...
Discrete from each other.
Yeah. So, I think in all Buddhist schools, they would say there are individual minds. But then, of course, we have to ask, are these minds, how are they related in terms of existence? So, of course, the lower two schools would say that the minds exist independently. And the Chittamatrans would also say that as well. Majjhimikas would not accept that assertion. So, as we're going to see in the Heart Sutra now, particularly the Prasangika interpretation, is when we talk about my mind and your mind, in the Prasangikas they would say my mind and your mind are neither the same nor different. The lower schools would say they're different. But Prasangika would say neither the same nor different. Because same and different implies duality. But anyway, we haven't come there yet, so.
We're not there yet.
Yeah. So, in fact, that's one of the arguments that they have. The two lower schools, which more or less, roughly speaking, follow classical physics approach, you know, these tiny little particles. So in the smaller school, in the lower schools, they would talk about these partless particles, these tiniest components of physical reality. But Chittamatrans would say, no, this is a little bit illogical, and therefore we don't have that problem because there are no physical particles. It's a projection of our mind. So that's one of the arguments to refute this external world. Because if you talk about external world, you have to talk about particles, and then where's the bottom? Where's the bottom? I mean, the lower schools say there's a bottom, there's the smallest particle. But then the Chittamatrans say, oh, you accept that? And then they point out all these logical absurdities positing that. It can't work. And so that's one of the arguments that Chittamatra can say, well, there you go. This is just an illusion. There is no particle world out there. So that's one of the arguments they use, in fact, to refute the lower schools. Well, for example, the lower schools, they would talk about a little bit like classical physics, you know. And, you know, I think originally in classical physics, they often talked about the unit of, was, you know, electrons, protons, neutrons, atoms. That was the basis. But then they went, oh, after some time, oh, no, no, there's some subatomic particles. Oh, no, 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 there's, so they keep going down. But at each level, they're saying, this is it. This is the basis, the bottom. And so the Vaibhashika Satrantika also say that. They say there's the smallest particle, but that has no parts. But then the Chittamatra, based on that, talk about logical absurdities that if there was such a thing, it would not have any spatial directions because it has no parts, which means that actually it could not occupy a spatial location. Which means how can you amass these things to have bigger particles? That's one of the arguments, but there are more arguments. But actually they're quite sort of convincing arguments that they have.
I was asking because when I read that Buddha found that there is
the smallest particle. Yeah, Kalapas. Exactly, that's that. Okay. That's from these two schools.
Okay.
Yeah.
So by then
he said, oh, no, no, no.
Is it quantum theory?
No, I mean, quantum theory, I mean, of course, quantum theory is relatively new and there are many interpretations, but quantum theory, of course, one of the ideas is that when we observe something, the observer impacts what we observe. The observer is part of the observation and has an effect on what we observe,
yeah, right.
Which that idea is very much in line with particularly the Majjhimika system. What, of course, scientists imply about that, there are many different ideas and not uniform. But at least I think some quantum physicists' ideas of what quantum events imply seem to be a little bit closer to the Majjhimika, some others not so close. Yeah, but of course the laws in the dream world are not the same as the waking world. So the analogy, you can't take the analogy to that. Analogies are only meant to show something simple. That would be taking the analogy too far.
Yeah.
Then it's not an analogy.
Yeah, but if so...
I mean, what it implies is that there is this interdependence between this experiencer and the experienced. And then what that implies within the world, of course, that's open to discussion.
Yeah, because I've read like that there is yogis that could, you know, have effect.
Yeah, manipulate. Yeah, of course. I mean, the power of the mind. But again, what is possible and not? That's of course open to a lot of discussion.
How do you believe it?
Yeah.
I can do that.
Yeah. Okay.
Chittamatra. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to talk about Chittamatra. Anything else about that? Of course, the Chittamatra system covers a lot of things, but I just wanted to briefly sort of introduce their idea to try and keep it as simple as possible.
I'd just be interested in wondering where does it exist today?
Okay. So remember, both Chittamatra and the Majjhimika systems are Mahayana ideas in the second and third turning of the wheel. So you find Chittamatran ideas within many of the Mahayana schools, Chinese, Zen, Korean, Vietnamese, Tibetan. Particularly in the Tibetan system, when we come to the Vajrayana Tantra level of practice, you find there a lot of the explanations have a very much Chittamatra flavor to them.
But also, I understand, I haven't studied, but I also understand that in Chinese and Zen Buddhism, they also, in some of their explanations, have a very much Chittamatra flavour to some of the explanations. Because again, this Chittamatra view can be very helpful at a practical level. You know, that there is no independent external reality. So remember, both Chittamatra and Majjhimika reject the same reality from the lower schools. They both reject independent external reality. But then they come to different conclusions. But, see, the thing is, in the Majjhimika system, we talk about the fact that there is an external reality, but it's dependent. But as soon as we talk about external, for us that means independent. So when we talk about there is an external reality that's dependent, we still slide back into, oh, there's independent, because that's our experience. Whereas the Chittamatra is clear cut. There is no external independent reality. So that's quite clear and can be quite helpful, particularly as His Holiness mentioned, like if we really accept that there is no external independent reality, then it actually becomes difficult to have craving and attachment for anything there, because we know that it's a product of the mind. And that is a little bit easier to appreciate in the Chittamatra view than in the Majjhimika view, which says, yes, there is external reality, but it's dependent. That's more difficult to appreciate. So that's why I think Chittamatra view, at a practical level, particularly for things like attachment, can be very helpful.
Have you ever heard of the concept of synchronicity? Is that...
Synchronicity, I've heard of it, but I don't know very well what it implies, but it could be something similar to the idea of interdependency within Buddhism, possibly. But to give a more better answer, I'd have to study exactly what synchronicity means.
But that concept does not exist in the Buddhism text.
Again, I'd have to look at what the implications of that view are and see whether there's something equivalent. I mean, the word synchronicity probably you won't find, but maybe something similar to that idea, concept exists. But again, I'd have to look at...
It's very much reflects or relates to the Buddhism.
And I think there at least is some overlap, but whether they really exactly match in their ideas, that's something we need to look at.
All those views we are discussing that are very complex, mere tools, because you often said, oh, His Holiness says this is very helpful to achieve enlightenment. Are they mere tools, but in fact it's not the truth?
So again, the Prasangika system, which we're going to be looking at in the Heart Sutra, is accepted as the truth within many of the Mahayana schools, Tibetan Buddhism for sure. But again, even if that school says this is the truth and all these other views are just helpful, we shouldn't blindly accept that. We, as a qualified student of Buddhism, need to check out all these views, see whether they make sense and whether they can help us. So it's up to us to determine, to decide from our own understanding and experience, which of these views are the actual truth and which are just helpful to us. That's what we have to find out. Yeah. But again, generally within the Mahayana schools and the Tibetan system, they would say that the Prasangika view, which we're going to be looking at, is the most subtle idea of reality that the Buddha taught. And the other views were helpful in terms of stepping stones. But we need to check that out ourselves.
Column of illustration of person.
Yeah.
Chittamatra uses mere mental consciousness.
Yeah.
So this mere in comparison to the others.
I can't remember exactly. I'd have to look at what the word mere there is sort of implying.
There we say the mind exists.
It may be, because in the Chittamatra system they divide the mind up often into these what are called the eight consciousnesses. So it may be referring to just one of those eight. Maybe that's what the word mere. I'd have to look up that. I don't know. I know what the word mere means in Prasangika, and we'll be covering that. But here, I'm not sure. It may mean simply one of those eight consciousnesses. Maybe that, but again, I'm not sure. Okay. Let's now move to the Majjhimika system. And again, we'll introduce the Majjhimika system reading a little bit from His Holiness's book on page 106, down the bottom. He says the following. In contrast to the mind-only school, or the Chittamatra school, the middle way school, that's the Majjhimika school, reads the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras as definitive, accepting the statement that all things and events are devoid of any intrinsic existence as literal. The middle way view does not discriminate between the existential status of subject and object, between mind and world. The 100,000 verses on the Perfection of Wisdom explicitly presents this view with the statement that on the ultimate level, all phenomena do not exist. So that for the middle way school, the Perfection of Wisdom sutras remain literal, and the emptiness of all phenomena becomes definitive. This distinction between the tenets of the mind-only school and the middle way school may not immediately seem important, but if we examine it closely, we can appreciate its significance. The mind-only school acknowledges the emptiness of phenomena in the external world, and because of this, they may be able to cut through attachment and aversion to external phenomena by recognizing the emptiness of these phenomena. But that is not enough. Unless one is able to recognize the emptiness of the internal world as well, one may become attached to such experiences as tranquility or bliss, and averse to such experiences as sadness or fear. Understanding the emptiness of all phenomena, not discriminating between internal and external, mind and world, is the refinement of the middle way school. Understanding this thoroughly for ourselves enables us to break completely free of the bondage of afflictions in all circumstances. Some middle way proponents, followers of a school known as the Yogacara Majjhimika school, maintain the mind-only distinction between internal and external worlds, but apply the teachings of emptiness equally to both. On the whole, however, the middle way schools teach that when it comes to the ultimate nature of reality, it is not just helpful to discriminate between external and internal worlds. Furthermore, Majjhimikas argue that one of the premises for the mind-only rejection of the reality of the external world is their belief that such a reality presupposes the existence of indivisible atoms or particles. Such particles, if they existed, would be the ultimate constitutive matter and act as a basis for the existence of the objective world. Since the notion of an indivisible absolute atom is untenable for them, they argue that one must reject the objective reality of the material world. The Majjhimikas respond to this by pointing out that one can use the same argument to negate the substantial reality of the internal world. For in order to accept the substantial reality of consciousness or mind, one must presuppose the existence of indivisible moments of cognition, which are also ultimate constituents of reality. This, they say, is untenable, for one can conceive consciousness only on the basis of a continuous, dependently originated stream of cognition, not as discrete moments of consciousness. Thus, even the internal world of consciousness and cognition is devoid of substantial reality. By applying this reasoning non-discriminately to both external world of matter and the internal world of consciousness, the adherents of the middle way argue that one can undermine the basis for attachment to both the external and internal worlds. So there we go. Ah, we're going to look at that. Okay. One further thing, because we see in the in this, both in the four Buddhist tenet systems and the objects of abandonment, that Majjhimika is divided into these two, Svatantrika and Prasangika. So remember, the Majjhimika philosophical system is being developed from this second turning of the wheel, where Heart Sutra is part of. And the Majjhimika system, philosophical system, really started to be formed by great Indian master Nagarjuna in the second century. But then his understanding of this emptiness was even interpreted slightly differently by different Indian masters following his time. And in particular, in the 6th century, there was a great Indian master, Buddhapalita, who wrote a commentary on Nagarjuna's text, trying to really understand more clearly what Nagarjuna was saying about emptiness. But then, a little bit later, also in the 6th century, we have another great Indian master, Baba Viveka, who disagreed with Buddhapalita. He said, "You didn't understand what Nagarjuna was really saying. This is what he really meant." And so then we have these two slightly different interpretations of the idea of emptiness. And those are the basis of these two schools. That the interpretation by Baba Viveka is the basis for the Svatantrika school, and Buddhapalita's interpretation is the basis for the Prasangika school. So to understand that a little bit more, just a little bit more from His Holiness's book here about this Svatantrika Prasangika distinction. The great Indian master Nagarjuna was the founder of the Middle Way school, and his most famous text, is his Fundamentals of the Middle Way, or in Sanskrit, the Mula Majjhimika Karika. And he says, "Among the many readings of Nagarjuna's text by subsequent Indian masters, those by Buddhapalita, Baba Viveka and Chandrakirti were particularly influential. In his commentary, Baba Viveka criticized some aspects of the earlier reading by Buddhapalita. In defense of Buddhapalita, Chandrakirti wrote the highly influential commentary on Fundamentals of the Middle Way called The Clear Words. One of the principal differences between Buddhapalita's and Baba Viveka's interpretations has to do with the notion of commonly appearing objects. That is, when engaged in a discourse on the ultimate mode of being of things, whether it is possible for two opposing parties to have a shared perception of an object that is equally valid from the perspective of both parties. Baba Viveka asserts that this is possible. In asserting an objective reality in some measure, independent of the perceiver, Baba Viveka accepts that a degree of intrinsic existence can be attributed to things and events. For example, Baba Viveka seems to maintain that although the person or self is a mental construct contingent upon the aggregates, if one searches for the true referent of the term person, one should be able to find something that is substantially real." That's what we see in this illustration of the person. We see that in Svatantrika, the illustration of the person is the mental consciousness, means we can find something. Baba Viveka singles out the mental consciousness as being the true person that can be found under ultimate analysis. Chandrakirti refutes this idea. Based on these two differences, two principal streams of middle way philosophy arose. The difference between these groups are reflected in the method used by their followers to establish emptiness. As Nagarjuna does in his Fundamentals of the Middle Way, Buddhapalita principally uses a form of reasoning known as consequentialist, or in Sanskrit, prasanga. This reducto ad absurdum reasoning proceeds primarily by demonstrating internal inconsistencies in the view of the opponent. In contrast, Baba Viveka and his followers reason from the basis of established syllogisms. Due to this difference in methodology, these two schools came to be known as Svatantrika or autonomous school, those who accept autonomous syllogisms, and the Prasangika school, those who prefer the consequentialist style of proof. Bhava Viveka's Svatantrika school was later upheld by masters such as Janagarbha, while Buddha Palita's Prasangika school was upheld by Chandrakirti and Shantideva. So, try to simplify that, is that, in fact, the words Svatantrika and Prasangika, Prasangika comes from prasanga, which means consequence. Svatantrika is coming from the base, which means autonomy. And it has to do with how you debate with someone on the nature of reality. One way you can do is you can make your assertion and then try to prove to the other person that your assertion is correct using this logical syllogistic reasoning. And that's what the word Svatantrika is implying. Or, if you are debating with someone about the nature of reality, you can use the opposite approach. You can look at that person's assertion and then use absurd consequences to show that their position is internally illogical. That's what prasangika or prasanga means, is that you really look at the other person's position and you use logic to them to show that their position is actually internally illogical. So that's the prasangika approach. And so that's how the names came about. But there is a difference in understanding of emptiness. And I'll try to make it very simple, the difference. Svatantrika also say that things are not existing independent of the mind. That they say that it requires an observer, a mind, for that object to come into existence. But their assertion is that there is some inherent qualities in the object itself. There is some sort of cupness there. But the cup only comes into existence when we have the cupness and the observer coming into contact. Then the cup comes into existence. And because there's some cupness quality there, that's why we see it as a cup and not as some other object. Whereas the Prasangika would say there's no cupness there. There's nothing inherent in the object that makes it that way. So one simple way of saying it is that the reality is coming 100% from the mind in the Prasangika, and we can say in a sort of poetic way that in Svatantrika it's 50-50. That there's sort of something coming from the side of the object, and then from the side of the mind, these two things come together, and then we have a cup, not before. And a analogy that's often used in the old Indian texts as an analogy for Svatantrika view, what they say is that, you know, in the old days there was magicians, and they would say that the magician would have a stick or a pebble, they would put that down, and then they would have this magic dust that they would blow into the eyes of the audience and say a few mantras, and then for the audience, instead of the stick, they'd see an elephant. But to see the elephant, they needed something there to start with, some basis. But they only saw the elephant because of the magic dust in their eyes. So that's sort of implying a little bit that there is some basis there, but it's only when that comes together with the observer that the phenomena really comes into existence. So that's the Svatantrika view. Whereas Prasangika would not agree with that. There's nothing coming from the side of the object that is the cupness in the object. So that's a little bit the sort of, try to be simple, the difference between Sautantrika and Prasangika. So they both say there's no cup existing independent of us. They both say the cup is imputed depending on the mind. But what that imputed means, again, a little bit different. For Sautantrika, there is something sort of coming from the side of the object, and on that basis we impute cup. Prasangika, there's nothing coming from the side of the object that suggests to us cup. There's no cupness there. So that's the sort of the two views, a little bit the distinction. Of course, there's a lot more to it, but just want to try and keep it simple. So any questions about Majjhimika and these two views? Everyone's confused.
Can you just go over the Prasangika?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Again, the Prasangika is the one we're going to cover.
Oh, okay.
So that's... I'm only want to present Sautantrika as a sort of a something to... Because it sort of seems like that to us, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah.
I think Sautantrika view, if we think about it, sounds sort of okay, you know?
Yeah.
Doesn't it? Doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the lower schools, that this cup is independent of us, we sort of think, well, not really, because it's only a cup when we sort of...
Human.
Yeah, there's some interaction that's sort of... Otherwise, you know, if it was independent, then a dog would see a cup, but they don't see a cup. So that sort of line of thinking, we can say, well, the lower schools sounds a bit not right. And then we come to Sautantrika, we say, oh, yeah, that seems right, because there's some quality coming there which we interpret and label as a cup, and some quality there that a dog would interpret as some sort of object to chew on or to play with. But there's still some sort of quality there. That's sort of Sautantrika view, which sort of seems, you know, not bad, reasonable. But the Prasangika view would not agree with that. So, but again, Prasangika is what we're going to try to look at now with the Heart Sutra. So again, Prasangika we're going to talk about a lot.
So, about the illustration of person, so earlier we started with the Atma, Atman, saying the concept of self-sufficient and substantially
existent
is to be refuted.
Yeah.
And then we have this illustration of person saying the mental consciousness.
In the lower schools, yeah.
In the lower schools.
Yeah.
So, How do we say that the mental consciousness is not self-sufficient and is not substantially existent? Otherwise, it's just a wordplay, right?
No, it is. The lower schools say it is substantially existent. The lower schools say that the body and the mind is substantially existent. That is the reality, that at the physical level, there is this substantial existence. The body is made up of these little tiny particles, so it's substantially existent.
Mm-hmm.
The mind is made up of these very tiny moments of experience, this substantial existence. So there is substantial existence there, but when it comes to the person, the lower schools say that the person is not substantially existent, because the person is something just labeled on that substantial basis. But we grasp onto the person as if it was substantial. That's the problem. But the basis is substantial. Because if it wasn't, nothing could exist. So that's what the lower schools assert. There is a substantial mind, there is a substantial body, there is a substantial reality. It's just that the person, of course, as we can sort of understand, is something just labeled on that basis. So it's imputed. It's not substantial.
Yeah, better understand about the person.
But, yeah,
So, I was just wondering, the mental consciousness, so we say instead of a self, there is this mental consciousness which is actually a real, or
yeah,
which
yeah.
is continuous.
Sure.
And mental consciousness will have the two characteristics that we actually discuss, saying self-sufficient, because it is continuous.
Self-sufficient. Well, I don't know if they'd use the word self-sufficient. Well, substantial existence, yeah, and self-sufficiency.
Because it continues even after...
Yeah, but I'm not sure about the word self-sufficient there, but certainly substantial existence, yes.
So we can, I think it's a little bit of a wordplay saying we don't want to use the word Atman, which we defined as having these two characteristics of self-sufficient and substantially existent, but we are saying there is something called mental consciousness, which is actually the real thing, which again have these two characteristics of self-sufficient and substantially existent.
See, the thing is that the person is something that we're labeling on the basis of the body and the mind. And if we were to understand that, we wouldn't have this grasping onto self. Because the person is just merely something labeled on the basis of the flow of the body and the flow of the mind. And so then the lower schools would say that if we correctly see ourselves as a person in that way, we would have no mental afflictions and no suffering. We would be achieving nirvana. But because we overinflate the sense of me, that we grasp onto the me, which is just something labeled on the basis of the body and mind, as something substantial, independent of that body and mind, that's the problem. Because when we look here, what do we find? We find the mental consciousness. We find the body. Where is the me that seems to be more than that? That's what self-sufficient, substantial existence means. That somewhere here, there seems to be a me that's more than the body and the mind. That's what we're grasping onto. But the real me, the one that's going from life to life, is within the basis, the mind. But we don't see it that way. We don't see me, the person, in that way. We believe that in addition to this body and mind, there's something more, self, something more than that. That's what we're sort of grasping onto, this self. But if we look, again, if we look here, what's here? There's the body, which is a constant flow of physical change. There's the mind, which is a constant flow of mental change. Is there something in addition to that? No. I mean, if we call self the continuum of the mind, then that's no problem. But that's not what we're relating to in our behavior. Are we, when we think self, are we relating to the continuous flow of our mind? I don't think so. If we were, we wouldn't have any problems. We think that there's something more than just that, more than this flow of body and mind, and we grasp onto that. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. No problem, but so the corpse, suddenly I saw the breath going slow, stop. So the corpse was there. My father, who is Catholic, said he was in very deep concentration. He said, she has arrived. And I, as a Buddhist, I didn't know how to deal with the corpse, how to, should I stay? Is the continuum still around? Because I think we are all going to face this problem.
Sure.
This is really the key where we can learn about impermanence, isn't it?
Of course. You know, all the Buddhist schools would say that there is after this death, the continuum of the mind continues on, but then the various different schools then grasp onto the person in different ways. And that's what we're trying to sort of clarify here. So if we want to, across the board in all Buddhist schools, we can say that, you know, when the breathing stops and brain activity stops, then shortly afterwards, the continuum of the mind, which is associated with this body, separates from this body and moves on to the next life. So in that way we can talk about it like that. And from the Buddhist perspective, then after that point, that mind then enters this, what's called the intermediate state, the bardo, where actually that takes on subtle physical form, and then it's looking for the next rebirth place. And some people, particularly if they're connected, can sense or that presence of that intermediate being. And again, what we find is that depending on our cultural and religious background, if we have that little bit of ability to connect with people, we will interpret that in many different ways. And that's why sometimes it can be very confusing when we listen to other people from other religions and traditions. For example, like with this idea of emptiness that we're going to look at, this completely non-dualistic experience. You know, if we're a Buddhist and we know all this understanding and we have our experience of emptiness, when we come out of that, we would say, you know, I've just had this experience of emptiness. Whereas if someone in a Christian tradition was contemplative and they came to the same experience, when they came out of that experience, they'd probably say something like, oh, I just had a union with God. I mean, at surface, they seem like completely different experiences. But it's probably some similar experience that is interpreted very differently depending on our framework for our understanding and our religion. So, you know, in this case, it may be that your father had an experience, a connection with the mother who had moved into this intermediate period, and he had some sense of her being there, possibly. I don't know.
But despite all the different views of the different schools about the mind, are they all looking at death the same way?
Because I think so, in very similar ways. What you find, I think, within the lower philosophical schools by Bhashyaka Sautrantika, they often just talk about, you know, when this mind disconnects from this body, you immediately go to the next life. Whereas within the two other schools, particularly Majjhimika philosophical system, particularly within the Tibetan Buddhist system, they talk about this bardo state. And the reason they talk about that is that particularly at the higher level of practice, the Vajrayana practice, which doesn't really exist in the lower two schools, there is an ability to influence that process. So therefore they describe that process in quite some detail, because at that level of practice it's possible to have some influence through that process. Where in the lower philosophical schools there is no practices to have any influence, so that it's never really mentioned. It just says, okay, you exit this life, the next life immediately begins. Because at a practical level, that's all we need to know. But again, within the higher schools, philosophical schools, because at the higher level of practice, there is that ability to navigate a little bit through the death process and through that intermediate period, then there's elaborate descriptions about that whole process. So that's why in some systems we see all this death process, intermediate period, and in other schools we never see anything about that. We just see, oh, person dies, exit, new life begins. Like that, I think. Yeah, I mean, that's, of course, the idea that, again, in this elaborate description, that the death process continues on after the breathing stops and brain activity stops, that there's a period of time there where we're going through more subtle death process before this mind exits. So they say that, well, better not disturb the body in that period. And that's why often they don't touch the body for some time. But how long that time lasts, I've never read any definitive, but I think generally it's quite quick anyway. Okay, let's go back to the Majjhimika system here. So that's a little bit the difference between Svatantrika and the Prasangika. So we'll be following Prasangika interpretation in our Heart Sutra discussion. So let's now go back to the Heart Sutra, where it says, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. So just a couple more things to mention here before we finish today. So again, this idea of empty of inherent nature, this emptiness, we're going to be looking at in detail tomorrow. And again, we see here those five aggregates also, meaning not just the person, but the basis of the person, the five aggregates, are also empty of any inherent nature. So this indicates also a little bit the order in which we are to approach this practice of emptiness, meaning that we should, it's recommended that we begin by investigating the person, me, the person. How does the person exist? Then the body and the mind. So it's recommended sort of do it in this order. Of course, you don't have to, but it's generally said that looking or investigating the person is one of the best places, easiest places to begin our investigation on the nature of reality. So that's a little bit implied in this statement here. Then we see the words correctly and repeatedly beholding. Actually, this word repeatedly here in the Tibetan is the syllable or word jesu, which literally means actually subsequent. It means subsequently. So another way of translating those first few words, instead of correctly and repeatedly beholding, is to subsequently see in a correct way. To subsequently see in a correct way that those five aggregates are also empty of inherent nature. And that subsequently see in a correct way means subsequent to what? It means subsequent to investigation. Subsequent to investigating. Which means that how do we approach emptiness practice as a beginner is that emptiness is not something that we can directly experience now. Because emptiness is what's called a slightly hidden phenomena. A slightly hidden phenomena is something that you can't initially directly experience through the senses. So an example of that slightly hidden phenomena, the one they often give in the text, is, you know, we look in the distance in the mountain and we see some smoke rising over there. Then, because of seeing that smoke, we can subsequently infer that there must be a fire there, even though we can't directly see the fire. But because of our understanding, we can infer that there must be a fire there. So that fire is a slightly hidden phenomena, meaning we can't directly observe it. Only through some signs can we infer that existence of that fire. Likewise here, it's only through logical reasoning that we can infer that things are empty of independent existence. So that's how we are to begin our emptiness practice, is by logically investigating reality. And through logically investigating reality, we can come to subsequently see that things are empty of independent or inherent existence. So that's sort of what's implied. So even on the path, because this part of the answer is referring to the path of accumulation and path of preparation, which means even at these two first stages of the path, we are having this inferential or conceptual realization of emptiness. And of course, this instruction here is the same instruction that we would use as a beginner. The difference here, of course, is that the person at this stage of the path has a very they've got bodhicitta, they have a very stable, clear mind, they have mind of shamatha. That's why when they do their logical reasoning and come to see subsequently that the person is empty of inherent existence, they have this conceptual realization. Whereas when we do the same thing, our mind is a little bit distracted and dull, and we may at best have a little taste of that, which sort of wears off pretty quick. But it's the same process, it's the same procedure. And so that's what the procedure that we're going to be looking at in a lot of detail tomorrow. How do we do this logical investigation into the nature of reality? So that's where I'd like to leave it today, is just that brief answer, is that we first investigate the person, the me here that seems to be, and logically investigate how does this me exist. I mean, now, of course, we're grasping onto this independent me. There seems to be an independent me here, an independent objective world out there. So what we need to do is investigate in a very logical way to see if there is an independent me here or not. And if we do that in a good, correct way, we will come to subsequently see in a correct way that the person is empty of inherent existence. That's the instruction here. How to do that, of course, we're going to look at it in detail tomorrow. Any questions about that before we wrap up for today? We've still got a couple of minutes left.
I'm just curious to know, are we going to touch any subject OBD? I mean,
oh, out of body experience? Yeah. Not directly, no. I can make a few comments on it now. The mind is very powerful, and, you know, I think that probably a large percentage of so-called OBEs can be discounted as hallucination, because the mind is very powerful in making things believable. But I think there are, and from Buddhism it's completely possible to have an OBE, valid experiences. But again, my understanding and my feeling is that a vast majority of them are just hallucination. In fact, there's very interesting, they're doing now a scientific study about this, because often these OBEs, out-of-body experiences, occur in operating theatres. You know, people are under sedation, and then they report floating above and report all sorts of things going on. And sometimes, you know, they're completely sort of knocked out, but then they report all these conversations that took place, and you know, from a Western medical perspective, this would be impossible. In fact, in some cases, there's one very well documented case where this woman had a problem with her brain, and the only way they could operate was to actually drain all the blood out of her body, stop the heart, stop all brain activity, completely flatlined, and because they needed to make some incisions and so forth. And so she was in this state for some hours, like zero brain activity, and then she reported all these events, you know, that all these nurses were talking and the doctors, and later she recounted it to them, and they were completely shocked, because, you know, if the mind is the brain, when there's zero brain activity, there should be zero mental function. But she reported all of this stuff. And so, you know, there are examples like this that are very powerful indicators that, you know, the mind is not really the brain. But what they're doing now, is I've heard, is they want to do an extensive medical study. I can't remember if it was in Europe or North America, but many operating theatres. And what they're going to do is, in the operating theatres, above a top of the cupboard, they're going to put like a picture that can only be seen from above, from the ceiling. So if someone reports an OBE, they're going to say, what did you see on top of the cupboard? And if they can't accurately describe, they'll just discount it as hallucination. So this is a little bit scientific approach. So they're doing this actually at the moment.
All of us could cheat in that experiment.
Is there any documents in the Buddhism?
Yeah. I mean, there are many cases of people consciously exiting the body and doing all sorts of things. There are many counts of that, yes. So, I mean, from a Buddhist perspective, this is certainly possible, because it's only the coarse mind that is supported on the brain. More subtleties of the mind are not dependent on the brain. So, therefore, yes, we can have that phenomenon. Yeah. Me? No.
No, like, have you seen or,
No. I think I don't seem to have any of these experiences. I must be very deluded or something. Okay, let's finish there then. Have a break, and then a a couple of meditations with Jonas this evening, of course. And then tomorrow we're going to be launching into the most famous part of the Heart Sutra. This form is empty, emptiness is form, and so on. And we'll try and sort of dissect this idea of emptiness and what it means and see how we go with that. So we'll be spending a couple of days on that coming up. So let's see how we go. Okay, let's have a break.